This is the PR Podcast, a show about how public relations helps you tell your story to the world. We talk with great PR practitioners who have the skills, creativity, and just plain savvy to get their clients noticed. Now here's your host, Jody Fisher.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the PR Podcast. I'm Jody Fisher. Thanks for joining us. Well, make sure you check out my weekly Instagram Live. You know, it's not any great shakes, but I'm trying to do a regular Instagram Live, and I do it every Thursday at 2 p.m. Now, that might be tough for some people to tune into, you know, the middle of the workday and all, but it's the time that's working for me, so we're going to go with it. And we're only on for about 15 minutes anyway. I just kind of check in, see what's going on, talk about maybe some breaking news or something else that's on my mind, something I haven't talked about in one of my crazy TikToks or, you know, my videos or anything like that. But it's an exercise for me. So join me in my exercise and tune in every Thursday, 2 p.m. on Instagram Live at Jody Fisher on Instagram. And throw in your two cents, because I love the feedback. I love to hear from you guys. I'd love to know what you guys are doing. And in the spirit of that, too, make sure you send in your PR podcast plug. So we can plug you at the top of an upcoming show, something cool that you're doing. We want to love on the people in our PR community and give them the props that they deserve. All right. Enough about me and enough about that. Let's talk about our guest for today. Anat Gerstein started her namesake firm in 2010 after years of seeing firsthand the support that nonprofits need to effectively tell their story. Prior to starting her business, Anat served as chief of staff and press secretary to New York City public advocate Betsy Gottbaum. She provided public relations services to top healthcare companies Eli Lilly and Cigna, developed effective communications materials for social service and other nonprofits, and promoted political candidates at the state and local level. She began her career in advertising, working on consumer brands like Vicks and Crest. She's a graduate of the New York University Stern School of Business and a Sabra Israeli native. Anat served on the New York Community Trust Nonprofit Excellence Awards Selection Committee from 2013 to 2018. Anat, welcome to the PR Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on.
How did you carve out a business serving nonprofits? I work for nonprofits too, but you really are the best in New York City at it. Tell us about the nonprofit business.
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that. You know, I had the great fortune of working for Betsy Gottbaum, who not only was a wonderful boss, actually still is, she's one of my current clients, but really introduced me to the nonprofit sector. I was a longtime New Yorker. I was born in Israel, but I've been here almost my entire life and didn't really know anything about nonprofits. I didn't really understand when I went to a museum that it was a nonprofit organization. I didn't realize after school programs were nonprofits or health institutions, or I mean, the list goes on and on. I didn't realize when I was walking through some great neighborhoods that the reason why they looked so great was because there were nonprofits behind it. But when I worked for Betsy, I got to know the sector a little bit. We did a lot of work with nonprofit organizations. We collaborated on policy papers. We went and visited nonprofits. We did press conferences with nonprofits. Spent really quite a bit of time getting to know them, the different ones. And I sort of fell in love and thought, wow, these are amazing organizations that make communities so much better. We all benefit from the nonprofit sector. But they're, you know, most of their stories are untold. And I thought, how lucky would I be if I got a chance to just spend all my day working with them? And so Betsy decided not to run for re-election when Bloomberg, this was sort of the height of the Great Recession, when Bloomberg made it so that the citywides can run for a third term. That's how Bloomberg got his third term. And Betsy decided not to run. I was out of work. I had always wanted to start my own business. And actually, we can get into this, in my 20s, I tried. But 2010, there wasn't much out there. I had always wanted to start my own business. Seemed like a perfect time. And I was, you know, fortunate enough to be in a position to be able to do that. You know, didn't have much business starting and decided to start a business that would just focus on serving nonprofits.
Do you remember who your first client was?
I do. We're actually cleaning out the office today because we're moving offices, and I found one of my very first notebooks because I'm old school and I write in notebooks. And my very first client was the Met Council on Jewish Poverty, which is not a small organization, but they gave me, but it was 2010, and a lot of nonprofits were struggling, as were a lot of people financially. And so the Met Council didn't have much funding, but they had this very small project. And I started with them on this tiny project, working for one of their subsidiaries in Jackson Heights. And then my second client was the Roosevelt Island Operating Corporation. I got to do the launch of the reopening of the Roosevelt Island Tram, which was just so much fun. And it all sort of snowballed from there.
Great starts, great clients, and great starts. And I can tell just by the look on your face there, you have so many great memories of that. I think we all get that as PR people, you know, representing our clients. When we get to dig into those fun projects, those projects, as you put it, that means something to people, you really get invested in that stuff. I frequently say that nonprofits need to make every dollar dance like it's 10, right? They have very limited funding, but they also have a lot of heart. And as you put it, they have wonderful untold stories. And as storytellers, and as a former journalist myself, journalists are highfalutin people. I was a reporter. we love telling stories, right? What are some of the ways that you dig in with your clients to find those stories that really tap into who they are and what they do?
Yeah. So one of the things that I love about the way we've kind of structured the firm and the way we do our work on a daily basis is we really dig in. We tell our clients that we need to be partners for this to be effective. And that means being at the table, being invited to, you know, meetings with program heads, being invited to senior leadership meetings, listening to what they're talking about in terms of stories that have happened, going to see programs. We love going to see programs, how they work, who they're working with, getting to know staff on the ground doing incredible work. And that really uncovers for us great stories. You know, the challenge, I think, with being able to come up with good stories when you're working in it, is to you, it's just Tuesday or Wednesday. It's the stuff that happens on a daily basis. You become so, it's not that you don't celebrate great moments, but they quite frankly happen with some regularity in the nonprofit sector. So to you, you know, somebody getting a job, a kid, you know, doing a great project, you know, these are things that happen with fair frequency. Now, of course, you know, we represent arts and culture institutions, and the opening of exhibitions obviously are a big deal and we make a big deal of it. But in terms of finding real stories, even with them, you know, if you're a curator and you've spent literally years pulling together an exhibition, you know, there's so many things you know, it's hard to kind of grasp at, like, they're all great stories to you. So really digging in, even with exhibitions, you know, after the initial opening, going and looking at individual objects and finding out the story behind them so we can get press coverage on the stories, you know, of the objects in the exhibitions are always great. So I think it's really just about it. To us, it's the fun work of spending time with clients and seeing what they're doing and learning about the people that they work with. And, you know, it's just fun. It's fun to be able to do that and talk to people. And ultimately, look, some of us come from the media world. You know, people on staff have been reporters, people on staff who've worked in government, people on staff who've worked for other nonprofits and in development. And it's kind of a really interesting bunch and a great bunch of professionals. But at the end of the day, we all love people and we all love learning their stories and getting to know them. And so that's kind of how we uncover stories. It's a very long-winded answer to your question, but really digging in and learning about what folks are doing and getting a little bit to experience what they experience on a daily basis. That's it.
No, I don't think it was long-winded at all. And I could see you light up as you were talking about it, because I feel the same way when I work with my nonprofit clients. And you're absolutely right that so many times they're so close to it. And they're also, I think by nature, rather humble people, because in working for nonprofits, you are used to getting your hands dirty on a lot of different things. And you can rarely farm projects out to other people on the staff because you are the staff, because there's so little staff. And so I feel like it's my job to sort of help people take that step back and recognize what each thing that they're working on could potentially be.
Absolutely.
And sort of lead them to like the realization that thing that they're working on is really cool and it's got this type of an application in media.
Absolutely. Right.
Right.
I agree. Your clients, I mean, it can't be their job to understand what a TV story is or what a great radio story is, right? That's why they need people like us to kind of say to help shape that for them. Or to tease out the, you know, they know like, oh, this is a great program director. She's so wonderful. But they often can't articulate why. They just know this person's great. And then it's up to people like you and I to really dig in and find out, like, what do you do? How do you do it? Why do you love your job? Tell me about some cool stuff that you've done. And out of that, you know, we get that spark.
But to your point, that's all we need. All we really need is for someone to, and the way I describe it is just recognize the wow. Recognize that when you look at this thing, you go, oh, that's really cool. You may not know why it's really cool. And you certainly aren't expected to translate that into what's really cool in media world. As you said, that's our job. But just point at the things that are really cool and we'll do the rest. And let us know and we'll do the rest, right?
Yeah, totally. Exactly. That's our role.
That's great. So now how big is your office now? How many folks do you have on staff and sort of what types of projects are you working on?
So we have a little more than 20 people on staff. We have 6 practice areas. So we are broken up into arts and culture, health and behavioral health, community development, education, and youth development, advocacy, and social services. So we have clients in each one of those practices. And gosh, we work with a lot of great organizations. It's really kind of hard to pick out, you know, ones that do tremendous work. But again, you know, that's just the nature of nonprofits. I think they're so undervalued. You know, you talk about this concept of having to make $1 stretch into 10 is really, I think, the unfair position that nonprofits have been put into when they contribute so much to the vitality of neighborhoods and cities and families and even individuals' lives, right? We go to, you know, some of the theaters that we go to are nonprofits, or some of the, you know, arts institutions or the classes that we take or the schools that we went to. So much of our lives are impacted by nonprofit organizations. And I think we need to value them more and support them more.
Yeah. And that leads into the question I had next, which is what are some of the challenges that you find your nonprofit clients are facing these days? Obviously, funding is always an issue, but are there other challenges that you help them navigate, whether it's media challenges or whether it's organizational challenges? Is it recruitment? Is it fundraising?
I mean, look, for sure, anything related to money is always a challenge for nonprofit organizations. A lot of organizations get money from government, whether it's city, state, or federal. The overhead rate on those contracts is really small. What do I mean by that? They pay you to deliver the service. So, you know, work with students to provide after school programming, but they don't cover the cost of the lights in your office or the phones that you need to make calls. So all of that overhead, or the insurance, by the way, that you pay your, you know, to for your employees to have health insurance. So nonprofits have that challenge, which is, you know, they get this money from federal and state and city contracts that don't cover the cost of doing business. They've been challenged. A lot of nonprofits have been challenged by just the challenges in our world, right? For a lot of nonprofits, the Trump years were really hard years. Organizationally, there are things that happened that were really antithetical to the mission of nonprofits. It made it harder for them to do their work. There are so many examples, and we could probably spend multiple shows talking about that. Nonprofits are challenged by what's happening in the world today. They deal with crises. The crises that people in New York see unfolding on our streets on a daily basis, but also the sort of pressures of the challenges that we see across the world that, you know, are felt here in New York. I mean, we are a global city, and it's not possible for things that happen, you know, even thousands of miles away to not be impacting us here.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. New York is kind of the pulse of the world. You know, everything that happens elsewhere, and the best city. Oh, without a doubt. Would go to the mat with anybody who says we're not, because we are.
I agree.
On the opposite side of that, what opportunities are you seeing in the not-for-profit sector? Are you seeing things out there that your clients are able to take advantage of? To make their organizations healthier or better? Are there new strategies? Are there sort of, you know, trends that are coming around?
Well, I think there's been a real big shift in the nonprofit sector from when I started, which really in the grand scheme of things in the nonprofit world is not that long ago. 13 years ago, when I started this business, there was, a core belief that communications wasn't as key as people see it now. So there has really been a shift in how much value nonprofit leadership places on the role of communications. I think people go into the nonprofit sector because they're mission driven, right? They want to provide social services. They really believe in the importance of arts and culture. They're arts people themselves. They believe in community development. They believe in, you know, healthcare services. And so they work in nonprofits, or they start nonprofits really with this deep commitment of doing good work. And they do plenty of good work. And for a long time, you know, they thought, well, we can just rely on this one source of funding. And I think increasingly, and certainly after the Great Recession, recognized the importance of a diversifying funding streams to support programming. And that requires you to communicate more externally, right? To get the attention of foundations, to get the attention of private donors, to get corporate attention requires you to be out there and be seen, and to have a diverse communication strategy that doesn't rely on one vehicle to get your message out. And so that's been a shift. And of course, you know, and Jody, you know this as well as anybody, like our world is shifting all the time, right? When I started in PR, I mean, I don't want to date myself, but like, you know, you would fax your press release and people would call you on the phone, and it was kind of slow go, but it's fine. There were like a lot of media outlets, and good stories were regularly picked up, and that's really changed. And social media is still an evolving thing. You know, Twitter to X, should I do it? Should I be on there? Should I not? You know, our world and the way we get our messaging out is constantly evolving. And nonprofits need to stay on top of how they're communicating with folks to make sure that their messages are seen.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I recently described all the changes that you just alluded to as job security for us communications professionals, because it does change so much that you need someone to help you navigate that. And that's our job, is to be that navigator for people who that's either true. Don't understand it, or don't have the time to understand it, or whatever the case may be.
But you're right.
The changes that have gone on in the last 20 years are amazing.
Yeah. And now we've got, you know, the elephant in the room, which is AI. You know, how is that going to change the landscape? You know, I think, you know, people are worried, rightfully so. I think there's also great opportunity in AI for nonprofits too.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. It's going to be interesting to see how all of this evolves. I think that's the thing that spooks people probably the most that hasn't been said out loud, is that people don't know how it's going to change things. That there are wonderful things that could happen. There are frightening things that could happen. Yeah. And usually reality lives in between both. And so it's our job to help people, as you said, navigate that path to their benefit. You wanted to talk a little bit about, and I found this really interesting, but I want to hear you explain it. The concept of what you call asset framing and using it to get press. Tell me about that. What is asset framing?
So first of all, I have to give all credit to Travian Shorters, who came up with this concept. I did not. We did not. It's brilliant. He put a name and a lot of kind of content and thought behind something that had been nagging at us for a while. And it's this idea in the nonprofit world that, and certainly in media, and I do want to spend a minute talking about sort of how we're trying to get the media to shift storytelling when it comes to reporting on some of the folks that we work with. But it's just this idea of framing people by their challenges or their deficits rather than their assets. So, Jody, when you introduced me on the show, you introduced me by the best things about me, potentially, right? You didn't talk about my awesome kids, but it wasn't in my CV, so I don't blame you. But, or my husband. But you talked about my career accomplishments. You didn't introduce me by my deficits, of which there are many that we can say for another show. But often in the nonprofit world and in media, when we're talking about people, we have had this reflex of talking about people and really introducing them and their challenges first and foremost. So at-risk kids or needy children, by the way, like, all children are needy, but you know what I mean in this context. Low income, homeless, and not just introducing them by the sort of the challenges that they're experiencing in life, but tying their whole self to those challenges by saying a homeless person. You know, a person is much more than that, and never defines themselves by their greatest challenges in life. And so asset framing is really about positioning people as more than just their specific circumstances, and really talking about people, about framing them about in ways that they not only would like to be seen as, but talking about their attributes, the things that they're great at, their accomplishments in life, much the way you introduced me talking about my accomplishments. And so we've taken this concept of asset framing, and people can Google this, asset framing, Travian Shorters. He's got plenty of videos. It's really not complicated work. It's just a narrative shift. It's a mind shift in the way we talk about people, the way we tell stories. And everybody can do it, and everybody should do it. And we should do it. And if you're going to ask why should we do it? It's because people find themselves in circumstances that are not of their own doing, right? Society has constructed systems that have put people in positions to experience great challenge, low income, right? When we describe people as low income, often that's because society has created systems that have perpetuated cycles of poverty for families. So why are we basically blaming people, saying, oh, that person is low income, when society has created the circumstances for them to be low income? Anyway, that's asset framing. I'm happy to tell you more and answer questions and talk about how we're doing this work with reporters.
Yeah, no, please go ahead. I mean, I hear exactly what you're saying. How does that translate then into your storytelling, and how do reporters receive that message or receive what you're telling them?
Yeah. So first of all, we use asset framing in all the content that we create for clients. So whether we're writing an annual report or an appeal letter, you know, we don't start with, you know, so-and-so is homeless and suffering on the streets. It's just not how we tell stories. But when we're talking to reporters, we're also highlighting this for them. We've actually, well, let me start by giving you a couple of examples. What does this mean in the press world? I'm going to read to you two headlines and talk about sort of what the problem is. So one headline comes from the Miami Herald. Will the real Ron DeSantis please stand up? His schizophrenic campaign gets called out. We're using the word schizophrenic in a way that reinforces stereotypes about schizophrenia. Certainly somebody who has schizophrenia through no fault of their own. It's an illness. And the way this headline reads is we're saying bad things about the DeSantis campaign, but we're also taking a whole group of people who are suffering through no fault of their own and also kind of throwing them into this quote unquote bad bucket. The next example, I like it even more as an example, because in this case, it's a local CBS station, not in New York, who set out to do this really great story about this wonderful program. So they're trying to tell a good story, and here is their headline. Quote unquote, you have value. Ex-cons determined to veer Milwaukee teens away from life of crime. So first of all, ex-cons is a terrible term, full stop. Second of all, you're talking about people with lived experience who are giving back to their community. Why would you define them by a crime they committed and, by the way, have paid for by being incarcerated? And then veering Milwaukee teens from a life of crime. I watched the segment. These kids do not have a life of crime. They are not criminals, but this piece, the headline, is calling them that. And so I think my guess is that the person who wrote the headline just wasn't aware, right? Nobody intentionally sets out to do this, mostly. And so what we feel it is our responsibility to do is just work with the media to give them some framing. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples, right? Because this is kind of new work and a lot of people don't understand this. And so this is not to tell anybody you're doing a bad job. It's just to say we have to shift the way we talk about people because it perpetuates stereotypes. And we owe it to people to do better by them. And so a couple of things that we do. We do responsible reporting guidelines for media outlets. So we helped Girl Scouts of Greater New York launch Troop 6000, which is a homeless shelter-based troop. And then they expanded it this past year to include younger girls living in transitional housing, migrant transitional housing. And so before we set up interviews or before we have the interviews with reporters and young girls, we send them a responsible reporting guideline. If anybody is interested in any of these reporting guidelines, we have samples on our website at anatgerstein.com/asset framing. So if you go to that, anatgerstein.com/asset framing, you will get a web page with information about asset framing. At the bottom of that page, we have three sample responsible reporting guidelines. But we literally say to reporters, things they can't ask, ways they can't frame. So we say to reporters, please do not call girls homeless. They are not homeless girls. They are Girl Scouts who are housing insecure. We do the same thing for the Museum of Jewish Heritage when they're interviewing Holocaust survivors. We ask reporters to abide by reporting guidelines that position people in the best light, and also importantly, don't re-traumatize them. So part of our work is to not allow people to be re-traumatized. And this, of course, applies to Holocaust survivors, but it applies to people who have experienced homelessness or substance use. It applies to people with behavioral health challenges. It applies to girls who are unhoused. I mean, young girls who have nothing to do with their circumstances are just experiencing them. And so we, you know, ask reporters to be sensitive to the experiences of people, to understand that if you're just starting to talk about your experience during the Holocaust, it might take you a while. And by the way, you're elderly, right? You're very elderly if you're talking about your Holocaust experience, to give people time and space and to meet people on their own terms when they're doing these interviews. We do the same thing for our clients who work with people who have mental health challenges, to talk about them in a way that doesn't stigmatize them. Some clients prefer that diagnoses not be disclosed. So we tell reporters, I'm sorry, but you can't ask this person about their diagnoses. And, you know, I went to a conference last month where I presented about our work on asset framing and how we work with reporters in the media. A reporter came up to me and said, you don't actually do this, do you? And I said, yeah, what do you mean? Of course I do this. Of course I do this work. You're presenting on it. And he said, well, I don't believe that you tell reporters what they can and can't say. And I said, well, we ask reporters to abide by responsible reporting guidelines. If they choose not to abide by those guidelines, we back out of interviews. It's rarely ever happened. As a matter of fact, in the last year, I could only think of one example where a reporter would not abide by our guidelines and we walked away from the interview. Every other time, people are more than willing to abide by this. Again, I think people are coming to this learning, and we're learning along with them. And so I think they're willing to do this because nobody wants to re-traumatize someone. I mean, you were a former reporter, Jody. Like, no reporter wants to cause trauma to somebody that they're interviewing. No reporter wants to perpetuate stereotypes. And so I think people are very open to this and willing to do it. And I think if we all kind of agree to do this work, we would really, really make a big impact in lifting people up.
I think it's a really interesting topic to bring up, and I'm so glad we had a chance to talk about this, because you're totally right. And I frequently say to clients, you know, when we're prepping them for interviews, you don't have to be afraid of the reporter. They're not here to play gotcha. You know, there are 20 reporters who play gotcha for a living. They're all sitting in the White House briefing room. The rest of the reporters of the world are rooting for you because they need you to tell a good story so they have a good story to tell their audience. And so it's really interesting to hear the interaction with the one reporter who was incredulous. Because my experience with most reporters is the exact opposite, that most reporters say, oh, okay, as long as they can do their job and do it in an efficient way and a way that, you know, ascribes to AP style and all the other, you know, rules that their publication may have set up, they're perfectly willing to engage with you on that topic.
100%. Yeah. I mean, reporters that sit down with nonprofits and are telling a nonprofit story want to tell a good story. They don't want to get anybody. They don't want to make the organization look bad. They're there to do a good story. So I agree with you. You know, nonprofits and folks should just feel more comfortable sort of explaining to reporters, taking the time to explain to reporters sort of some background information, helping them understand where people are coming from, the circumstances that have led people here. I mean, I'm obviously talking a lot here about social service organizations, but it applies to anybody. You go to an after-school program, you kind of got to walk in understanding the context that led people to be in the room in order to be sensitive enough to ask the right questions, and to not frame questions in a way that, you know, God forbid, can embarrass the person that's being interviewed, or make somebody not look as great as they are. You know, we meet people who have gone through some of the— am I allowed to curse on this show? Because I love to curse, and I haven't cursed yet.
We are four-letter word friendly on this podcast. Okay. Go right ahead.
So we meet people who have gone through some really seriously bad shit in life. I mean, grew up in really fucked up circumstances, not of their own doing. And they have worked really, really, really hard to overcome those circumstances. And those people should be held up on a pedestal by society. And the way we talk about them matters. And that's all we're trying to do here with, you know, with— and again, shout out to Travian Shorters for sort of creating the framework, the asset framing framework, so that we can do this work better.
Well, and it's a great thing that you point out there too, because I think that's what nonprofits probably do best in our world, is they move the needle on these types of things that you're talking about in ways that other, let's say, more other institutions might be afraid to do, right? Whether it's a big financial institution or it's a big real estate company or something, you know, and they're going to shy away from this because of money or threats to, right, to how they do business, in a way that nonprofits are fundamentally programmed to sort of, you know, put up their knuckles and throw hands because this is what they do.
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting that this is that you're using this with your nonprofit clients. I think it's sitting in just the right place.
Thanks. We're really happy to be doing it. I think the whole team here is just really excited to be storytelling in this way and to be working with reporters. And again, we've gotten great feedback. Our clients have been invited to sit down with, you know, editors to talk about and give their, you know, reporters at various newsrooms sort of a deep understanding of the backgrounds that people could go in and report on it with that knowledge. That's so important to understand, like, where folks have come from and what they've dealt with to do good reporting. And I think, you know, most reporters want to do good reporting.
I think most of them do. Well, please keep us posted on how that goes. We're going to watch it evolve. And we're really terrifically glad that you guys are leading the way. We are going to pivot now into the rapid fire question portion of our podcast. This is where we steal a page from Inside the Actors Studio. We're going to have a little bit of fun. I can see you're very excited and not. And that means that you've heard this before, so you know what's coming. With your indulgence, here we go with rapid fire question number one. Anat Gerstein, what is your favorite news source?
Oof. New Yorker.
The New Yorker. Very good. Very good. Rapid fire question number two. What's your favorite social media platform?
LinkedIn.
LinkedIn. Yes. Yes. Rapid fire question number three. This is a New York answer. Coffee or alcohol?
Both.
That is fair. That is fair. And here's an even better New York answer. Rapid fire question number four. What is your favorite on the run food?
I'm, you know, I thought about this question. I'm really terrible at answering it because I'm going to say something really pathetic, like a bar.
Right. Right. But go ahead. Give us a New York answer. Go ahead.
Wah, wah. A bagel. That's a New York answer, a bagel.
Yeah, but see, when you say a New York bagel, there's something really wonderful about that.
No, this is true. This is true. I was just not in New York. And let me tell you, you cannot eat bagels outside of New York.
Yeah, that's right.
Bad
things happen when you leave New York.
Bad things happen when you leave New York. I mean, some wonderful things happen when you leave New York, but wonderful things always happen in New York.
We're making t-shirts and bumper stickers. I'm with you. All right. And rapid fire question number 5, what do you want to be after you finish this career?
Retired.
That is actually a goal for Gen X. That is actually a goal. Like, because I read something yesterday in the New York Times that said we're not supposed to be retiring anymore because we need to keep working to feed the social security system. And I'm like,
yeah, Gen X, we get to do everything.
We do. It's our job, right? We have to save the world.
Yes, exactly. Oh, exactly. I mean, we're not really doing a very good job. We're going to have to rely on. What's the generation after Z?
What is it? X, millennial, Z, and I think it's alpha. Are our kids alpha? My kids are 14 and 11. So I think they're alphas.
Mine are 14 and 16. Alphas. Okay. I leave it to the alphas. I've got a lot of hope in the alphas.
I do too, because there are kids, right? And we were the kids who grew up having to deal with everything that we had to deal with, right? And it was like, toughen up, kid. Basically, that's the way I was raised. And so that's kind of the way I'm raising my kids, with just a little extra love.
I'm totally with you. It is exactly how I'm raising my kids. And I don't know. I think seeing my kids and their friends, I think that I really have hope for a better future with that generation.
I do too. I watched, my son is a freshman in high school, and I watch him go with his friends, and they can figure stuff out. They can go do, they can build stuff, and they can fix stuff, and they can figure out problems. They're still, you know, every once in a while, they're a little hopeless. I'm like, yeah, well, but they're 14. It's okay.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You got to cut them some slack. You got to cut them some slack.
I'm with you. Well, Anat, this has been a great conversation. Please let people know how they can find you online.
AnatGerstein.com.
Fantastic. We'll look you up. Anat, thank you so much again. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Please remember to subscribe to the show. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at The PR Podcast, and send us a question or a comment. Our intro is by Christopher Apple. You can find him and his fantastic photography on Instagram at Christopher_APPOLDT. Check him out there and hire him for all your photography needs. You can find me online at Jody Fisher on all the socials and on the web at jodyfisherpr.com. We'll see you next time on the PR Podcast.